Sergeant Casey Nelson has more.
Army Major Daniel Smith wanted to serve with the Canadian Airborne Regiment, but it disbanded before he had a chance. Through the Canadian Military's exchange program, he found another job within the airborne community. In 2003, Smith moved with his wife to Fort Bragg, North Carolina, taking a position as a logistics officer for the 18th Airborne Corps.
You know, for all intents and purposes down here, I'm a U.S. Army officer. I wear a different uniform, but that's about it. Everything I do is what a U.S. Army officer would do.
Major Smith will finish his tour with the American Army this summer, but he will not be leaving the airborne community. He's taking command of a company at the Canadian Army's Parachute Center. From Camp Victory in Baghdad, I'm Army Sergeant Casey Nelson for the Multinational Corps Iraq Public Affairs Office.
Students in the Nursing Reserves Officer Training Corps are getting real-world experience during their summer internship program. Airman Natalie Anderson has the story.
ROTC has a nursing summer training program that enables students to go to an Army facility for 4 weeks overseas to learn how to function as a nurse and officer. 8 Delta Charge Nurse, Army First Lieutenant Parker Hahn.
The experience that they get here is unparalleled to anything that you get in the nursing school. They get real good hands-on opportunity here because most of our patients here are traumatic war injuries from downrange.
Cadet and student nurse Laura Strecker.
We get one-on-one instruction from an officer already in the Army, so we get instruction not only for nursing skills and everything.
Propaganda station, imperialist station. Yeah, what the hell are you guys babbling out, talking about some Canadian fool who comes over to the U.S. to be an army officer? Basically, you're a stooge for the empire, and your head's gonna roll off his soldier, off his shoulders, just like American heads are rolling off their shoulders. And if I can help out, hey, just come on down to West Oakland. We'll happily oblige. And then you clowns have the nerve to put on this nonsense about nurses who are getting unparalleled experience and going down in this ROTC nonsense. Well, yeah, but no matter how good of a nurse or a doctor or a surgeon you may think you want to be, all the king's horses and all the king's men are not going to stitch a chopped off the U.S. head on his shoulders again. You know what time it is, slave time. Check it. You're listening to 103.3. 101.1 Santa Cruz with Skidmark, 106.7 Illinois, LUVER.com, The World, 107.5 North Carolina, and RadioForAll.net, The Universe. And check out the Slave Web. Go Google Slave Revolt Radio. Find out what time it is. Tonight, we're going to explore how extremism is in the eye of the beholder. So as we begin to roar, find out what else we have in store on 103.3 Slave Revolt.
They just didn't care what the consequences were. They knew they cared nothing about legality, morality, or anything. All they knew was that they were being oppressed unjustly, illegally, immorally. And because of this unjust, illegal, immoral oppression that they were suffering, they came to the conclusion that they would be within their rights to bring it to a halt by any means necessary. And they adopted those means.
I think that change will only come through struggle. And, of course, as I pointed out, and I recapitulate that we don't want war, but if it's necessary for us to wipe war out with some strong tactics, we're prepared to do this.
The difference between being projected as an extremist or a monster is only depends upon who controls the projection. If you project your own image, then you are able to project the positive image. But when your enemy is your master, and when your enemy masters the press that's going to build, create this image and project it abroad, then naturally your enemy is going to project you in the image of a monster. Because a reporter was asking me a few moments ago to either confirm or deny the statement that the Times had mentioned, where I said we need a Mau Mau in the United States. I never would deny that. Why, we need more than a Mau Mau in the United States. I mean, actually, a person would have a lot of nerve to ask me that. In a society, in a society, I'm deviating now, because he put me off the track. I got to deviate. In a society where in 1964 three civil rights workers can be murdered in cold blood, and the massive Mississippi government, the federal government, can't do anything about it, I say we need a Mau Mau. When a Negro educator can be murdered in Georgia, and they know who murdered him, and the government can do nothing about it, I say we need a Mau Mau. And I'll be the first to join it. And a lot of people that you don't think go for it will line right up behind you.
Terms like terrorist, extremist, are often thrown out into the public arena to set a tone or label their desired targets and to present themselves, the state, and the defenders of the existing ruling, dominating orthodoxy as moderate, which symbolize stability, reliability, maturity, a form of flexibility, and longevity. This is a myth a slaves have always challenged. From Frederick Douglass's 1854 speech, "What to the Slave is Your 4th of July?" to Malcolm X in a debate at Oxford University Union in England on December 3rd, 1964, that dealt with extremism in the world. By who, against who, and who's labeled that way, who's not, and how they control the labeling apparatus. Well, as we'll call it, extremism is in the eye of the beholder. So first, let's go into what Malcolm had to say. As Malcolm talks about extremism, as he's dealing in a debate with a conservative exploiter for the basically a spokesman for the dominating class. So this guy just got through talking and pointing various labels and outlining Malcolm as an apartheidist and things like that. So here's how Malcolm opens it up in this debate in front of the Oxford students. Check it out.
To be as near to conservatives as I am. And the speaker who preceded me, first I want to thank you for the invitation to come here to the Oxford. The speaker who preceded me is one of the best excuses that I know to prove our point concerning the necessity sometimes of extremism in defense of liberty, why it is no vice, and why moderation in the pursuit of justice is no virtue. I don't say that about him personally, but that type is the... He's right. X is not my real name. But if you study history, you'll find why no black man in the Western Hemisphere knows his real name. Some of his ancestors kidnapped our ancestors from Africa and took us into the Western Hemisphere and sold us there. And our names were stripped from us, and so today we don't know who we really are. I'm one of those who admit it, so I just put X up there to keep from wearing his name. And as far as this apartheid charge that he attributed to me is concerned, evidently he has been misinformed. I don't believe in any form of apartheid. I don't believe in any form of segregation. I don't believe in any form of racialism. But at the same time, I don't endorse a person as being right just because his skin is white. And oftentimes when you find people like this, I mean that type, when a man whom they have been taught is below them has the nerve or firmness to question some of their philosophy or some of their conclusions, usually they put that label on us, a label that is only designed to project an image which the public will find distasteful.
Okay, so as you can hear, this is a pretty... uproarious crowd as Malcolm's putting on his little clown hat as he goes after this guy. But Malcolm gets into some of the fundamental questions of how the state and its media apparatus often operate and how they're quick to slap particular labels on you. As most people are probably aware, this woman Sheehan, who lost her son He was a soldier, G.I. Joe, U.S. Army soldier, and he went over in to Iraq and got himself killed. And she has informed herself on these particular issues concerning the war, and she's against it. And she's challenging, or wants to challenge, Boy George face to face and question him and some of his particular positions and stuff. Boy George is hiding out in his, his little bunker in Texas and stuff, you know, tough cowboy. But if you've witnessed some of the corporate media hacks on Rush Limbaugh and Bill O'Reilly, they've gone to the point where they've called her actions being extreme. All she's doing is camping out, waiting to try to get a opportunity to speak to the fool. And Bill O'Reilly has even tried to portray this as undermining the troops. So here you have this type of painting of a picture that is taking place on any portion of the population that in any way wants to critique or challenge the integrity, actions, or overall interest of the state. So in the same way that Sheehan, as you can obviously see how she's being characterized and turned into a caricature, and O'Reilly was saying that she's being used by the far left, and you know, all this type of, they telling her what to say, all this rhetoric and stuff. In the same way that he's trying to put that out there and market it so that the diddleheads can turn back off their little lights as soon as it starts to dim somewhat on because of an issue that is not as easily manageable for the orthodoxy as normal. Here comes these hooligans, Limbaugh, O'Reilly, and the rest of the company, to put the label on. And in a country that has been indoctrinated with symbolisms, with very simplistic symbols and ways of characterizing people that are deeply embedded in the fabric of American racism, black inferiority, red savages, etc., etc., all of these terms and ways of exploiting other human people for their land, for their resources, for their labor, are deeply embedded historically and currently in the American fabric of this country. And this country has always deeply embedded itself on soundbite types of terms and stereotypes, so that once a group has been labeled a particular way, immigrant, slave, native, whatever, they are more easily controlled, manipulated, and when necessary, exposed of or disposed of by that ruling orthodoxy. But next, Malcolm talks about tricks of the West with images and its justifications of extremism. So check them out.
Time to make these few things clear, because I find that one of the tricks of the West, and I imagine my good friend, or at least that type, is from the West. One of the tricks of the West is to use or create images. They create images of a person who doesn't go along with their views, and they make certain that this image is distasteful, and then anything that person has to say from there on in, is rejected. And this is a policy that has been practiced pretty well, pretty much by the West. It perhaps would have been practiced by others had they been in power, but during recent centuries, the West has been in power. They've created the images, and they've used these images quite skillfully and quite successfully. That's why today we need a little extremism in order to straighten a very nasty situation out, or a very extremely nasty situation out. I think the only way one can really determine whether or not extremism in defense of liberty is justified is not to approach it as an American or a European or an African or an Asian, but as a human being. If we look upon it as different types, immediately we begin to think in terms of extremism being good for one and bad for another, or bad for one and good for another. But if we look upon it, we look upon ourselves as human beings. I doubt that anyone will deny that extremism in defense of liberty, the liberty of any human being, is a vice. Anytime anyone is enslaved or in any way deprived of his liberty, that person is a human being. As far as I'm concerned, he is justified to resort to whatever method necessary to bring about his liberty again.
Alright, so you can see the dynamic that's taking place. Essentially, Malcolm's talking about what generations of black people on one side of the coin have talked about concerning our emancipation from the Terradome. In that we have the right to a variety of methods that by necessity will have to go outside of the bounds of the slaver who is trying to confine us to a particular type of mode of operation that's all within his system. You know, you gotta vote your way out of it, et cetera, et cetera. So Frederick Douglass came across this same dynamic that Malcolm found himself in. And in the same type of debates, Frederick Douglass realized that the way and the interest of the slaver within the slaveocracy in America was set up, that they weren't about to turn loose the chains of America's slave without a fight. You can get as philosophical, as emotional, as quote-unquote spiritual as you want and try to reach them. But at the end of the day, these guys, like all elite ruling dominators who want to control resources and the masses of people for their labor and land and et cetera, they're motivated by the gold in their pocket. And at the end of the day, that is what's going to have to be dealt with. So there was a split in the abolitionist movement that agreed with Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman that the need to end chattel slavery in America was a must. But they didn't agree with Harriet Tubman and Frederick that the people opposed to it should use any means available to end it. This was considered not only by the slaver, of course they're going to say, because anything opposing slavery they labeled as extremism. But even by many of the abolitionists, and in many ways it really was close to breaking down, not on absolute racial lines, but it was overwhelmingly on racial lines, where blacks abolitionists were by and large for any means to end it. And a large number of whites, not all, of course we know about John Brown and cats like that, were for nonviolent ending. Now, as it turned out, the dynamic of the Civil War imploded on the North and South, where you had a portion of the population, elite population, that basically made its labor off the exploitation of wage slaves, you know, primarily in the North. And then primarily in the South, you had those who made their extreme wealth off of the exploitation off of slave labor. And they were all within the same country. And each time the state expanded, i.e. conquered more Indian native aboriginal territory, a conflict arose which way it was going to tilt. And this dynamic became more and more of a precarious one as the empire was starting to expand, and who was going to have more influence was basically being carried out as the country was expanding. And there you have a core part of the dynamic that it exploded into warfare. Frederick Douglass, Harriet Tubman, of those like, saw the opportunity, and then many of the cadres behind them, i.e. 200,000 black soldiers who also saw the opportunity to crush the South, took the opportunity, and that's how the South was defeated. So it was defeated. The South was defeated under a philosophy of a people who left all options open and seized the time when that opportunity came. It doesn't always come, or it can come who knows when. The thing is if you've been prepared politically, physically, et cetera, to seize upon it. It was no accident that many people behind and with Frederick Douglass were prepared, because Frederick Douglass had operated his North Star printing press, where he put out his polemic on the issue. He convinced his cadres. So they were psychologically in preparation for an opportunity to strike back at the state. Not that they had any illusions about the North, but they saw the weakness in the fabric of the state itself and saw a way of crushing an aspect of its most barbaric apparatus, the genocidal aspect of the slave trade. Which, by the way, it should be noted, from the aspect of black peoples in Americas, in North Americas, from the concept of the most important advancement black people have made, that crushing a chattel slavery was, to this point, the most important advancement we've made so far. More important than the civil rights movement with their reforms and all of that. But see, often in ahistorical America, things aren't put into proper perspective, and it just starts to hover around King and Gandhi and, you know, and all of that type of stuff, you know. What's also interesting about what Malcolm was saying was the Westerner images and the whole little trick bag that they play out. And we've seen this take place time and time and again. You know, take someone like Manuel Noriega. Manuel Noriega wasn't a bad guy for the U.S. rulers for a long time. He was on the CIA payroll, friend of Pappy Bush. But he went from good guy to bad guy to ugly, like a Clint Eastwood movie. The good, the bad, and the ugly, basically overnight. And a core part of that manipulation was by the corporate media. The Contras. Here, these savages, these barbarians, have been portrayed since their rise out of the sewers of American imperialism as freedom fighters, as Ronald the Crip Reagan called them. Uncle Ben, Bin Laden, at least his Mujahideen was not characterized in a negative light overall, you know, when they were being developed by the CIA, Pakistan, that whole little network that was going on, because they were being used as a bullwhip against the then Soviet Union. But now, of course, Uncle Ben, who's still within the fold, this is all a script that these clowns are playing. His image is easily flipped. You have, of course, the situation where often, if these guys are not painted as good, they're more or less invisible. They don't really talk about them. They don't bring up their record as much, you know. So that's more or less the case of a Saddam. You know, so Saddam, who got his rise through U.S. imperial interventions in the 50s and stuff, he was involved in all types of mass murder and unwarranted wars and what have you. But he was down with the cause, the imperial cause of the empire. So these types of images and pictures about Saddam were not going to be painted in his full light. But as soon as they decided that the next chapter needed to be written on the grand chessboard, then of course his image flipped, just like Noriega's image has flipped. And, you know, so this type of thing goes on and on. And this is why those who see the U.S. empire as reformable or any of that type of stuff, that's a form of, in reality, of, if not extreme naivete, it's a form of extreme complicity. But next, Malcolm goes into some of the psychology of those in power versus oppressed in relationship to the concept of extremism.
But most people usually think in terms of extremism as something that's relative, related to someone whom they know or something that they've heard of. I don't think they look upon extremism as it's by itself or all alone. They apply it to something. A good example, and one of the reasons that this seems to be too well understood today, many people who have been in positions of power in the past don't realize that the power, the centers of power are changing. When you're in a position of power for a long time, you get used to using your yardstick, and you take it for granted that because you force your yardstick upon others, that everyone is still using the same yardstick. So that your definition of extremism usually applies to everyone. But nowadays, times are changing, and the center of power is changing. People in the past who weren't in a position to have a yardstick or use a yardstick of their own are using their own yardstick now. You use one and they use another. In the past, when the oppressor had one stick and the oppressed used that same stick, today the oppressed are sort of shaking the shackles and getting yardsticks of their own. So when they say extremism, they don't mean what you do. And when you say extremism, you don't mean what they do. There's entirely two different meanings. And when this is understood, I think you can better understand why those who are using methods of extremism are being driven to them. A good example is the Congo. When the people who are in power want to use, again, create an image to justify something that's bad, they use the press. And they will use the press to create a humanitarian image for a devil, or a devil image for a humanitarian. They'll take a person who's the victim of the crime and make it appear he's the criminal, and they'll take the criminal and make it appear that he's the victim of the crime. And the Congo situation is one of the best examples that I can cite right now to point this out. The Congo situation is a nasty example of how a country, because it is in power, can take its press and make the world accept something that's absolutely criminal. They take American trained, they take pilots that they say are American trained, and this automatically lends respectability to them. And then they will call them anti-terrorists. Cuban, anti-Castro Cubans, and that's supposed to answer their respectability. And it eliminates the fact that they're dropping bombs on villages where they have no defense whatsoever against such claims, blowing up the bitch. Black women, Congolese children, Congolese babies. This is extremism. But it is never referred to as extremism because it is endorsed by the West, it's financed by America, it's made respectable by America, and that kind of extremism is never labeled as extremism. Because it's not extremism in defense of liberty, and if it is extremism in defense of liberty, as this text has just pointed out, it's extremism in defense of liberty for the wrong type of people.
All right, so you can see many things that Malcolm hit on that in many ways we still deal with today. And the whole dynamic of what we're engaged in. First, let's take how the bombing in London has been characterized. You know, many people in London and throughout the world, when the bombing took place, of course, since the state characterized it as a form of extremism, even though they were the ones who orchestrated it, but nevertheless, since the state characterized it as a form of extremism, it let them use their state apparatus of control to be ratcheted up even more. So now they've issued in the shoot to kill policy, where they're blasting people multiple times in the head. And the first casualty was, of course, the Brazilian cat. Now, that's not characterized as extremism. And the role of the corporate media, of course, is to defend the state. As far as what the state needs to do in defense of extremism, at the same time, go to the extremes in not pointing out the holes and the hypocrisy and the obvious manipulation that has gone on concerning the London bombing and how these so-called characters who were involved is implausible. But this is all part of how the state apparatus within the corporate media system works. Now, Malcolm brought up the Congo and the humanitarian missions, and this is another term, you know, extremism, humanitarianism. The state uses terms like that. Now, the Congo was in the 60s. That was essentially the fight for Africa, and because the Congo touches so many countries and is so centrally located, and who ended up, what kind of society ended up being in power and in control of their own destiny, or not in control of their own destiny as it turned out, would help determine the role many of the other countries around it would play out. This is why Che Guevara went down in the Congo in the mid-60s, because he, like many others, saw it pivotal, and he saw that the U.S. imperialists and other imperialists, France and all of that, were Belgium, were shooting their mercenaries over there to destroy any kind of democratic evolutionary process that was trying to take grip there. These guys were the beast itself, and Che fought tooth and nail to try to get something. Now, by the time Che had gotten there, it was already too late. There was the penetration by the imperialists, the soldiers of fortune, the soldiers of death had already unfortunately laid the course for what was to come. So Che and many of the Afro-Cuban cats who came here to help out in the struggle, it was it was just turned into a disaster that has a direct lineage that you can see today. But as Malcolm was saying, all that time they were painting it out as Sam and the media were painting it out as a humanitarian type of issue that they were doing. While at the same time, they were mercenaries. They were imperialists coming in to undermine the process. And you ended up having people like Mobutu and Shambe end up working within the power structure of the U.S. imperialists, undermining the process that was developing, CIA assassinations of Patrice Lumumba, and essentially with Mobutu in power, they were able to then have a figurehead that would help their tentacle outreach in that centrally located country throughout the rest of Africa to keep the liberation process that was developing at that time undermine and collapse it as it ended up being. But they use terms like humanitarian in the Congo intervention in the same way that they used it in Somalia. At the same time, they were, of course, roasting alive little kids, you know, and stuff like that. So this is the art of a manipulation by the structure of the society. So it comes down to attacking not only how the enemy defines us, but how the enemy tries to define him and what he does. See, this is also why even like terms like, you know, you hear people trying to be politically correct and say we shouldn't say pirate radio, we should say micro radio and all of that type of stuff. Where at the end of the day, the way people's mind is so rigid in this kind of American law and order type of structure, all they have, regardless of what they say you're doing, if somewhere in that page they're saying you're an illegal broadcaster, that for many of the drones without throughout this society will turn them off, because anyone who stands up to the laws within this particular society is challenging in their mind the structure which they think is fundamentally something that should not be challenged, or should be challenged in the quote-unquote appropriate channels. So getting caught up in thinking that you're going to somehow convince people that what you're doing is not on the level of outlawism because you used, you know, terms like micro or whatever, or low power, when in reality, it's the whole mindset of portions of the population that is warped. And putting out what you need to do and how you need to do it is of essence in just going ahead and doing it. So, and not worrying about what, you know, overall misconception people has outside of challenging it, doing what you have to do and moving on. So, but next, we have a situation where Malcolm goes on further with the corporate media's use of images, like the criminal I just mentioned earlier, Shambe, who was basically turned into an angel by the U.S. Empire, image-wise.
That thing of extremism, that cold-blooded murder. But it is, but the press is used to make that cold-blooded murder appear as an act of humanitarianism. They take it one step farther and get a man named Shombi, who is a murderer. They refer to him as the premier of the prime minister of the Congo to lend respectability to him. He's actually the murderer of the rightful prime minister of the Congo. They never mention that this man. Of that kind of liberty or that kind of activity. They take this man who's a murderer. The world recognizes him as a murderer, but they make him the prime minister. He becomes a paid murderer, a paid killer who's trapped up by American dollars. And to show the degree to which he is a paid killer, the first thing he does is go to South Africa and hire more killers and bring them into the Congo. They give them the glorious name of mercenary, which means a hired killer. Not someone that's killing for some kind of patriotism or some kind of ideal, but man who is a paid killer, a hired killer. And one of the leaders of them is right from this country here. And he's glorified as a soldier of fortune when he's shooting down little black women and black babies and black children. I'm not for that kind of extremism. I'm for the kind of extremism that those who are being destroyed by those bombs and destroyed by those hired killers are able to put forth. They will risk their lives at any cost. They will sacrifice their lives at any cost against that kind of criminal activity. I'm for the kind of extremism that the freedom fighters in the Stanleyville regime are able to destroy against these hired killers who are actually using some of my tax dollars that I have to pay up in the United States to finance that operation over there. We're not for that kind of extremism. And again, I think you must point out that the real criminal there is one of those who are very much involved as accessories to the crimes of the press. Not so much your press, but the American press, which has tricked your press into repeating what they have invented.
So once again, you have a situation where, like, in some ways, you see, when Malcolm's talking about these hired killers and mercenaries and soldiers of fortune, you know, it's interesting that, because they have a magazine out. You can go in, like, the Tower Records in the book section and see these, or a lot, bookstores. In the magazine section, you'll see the Soldier of Fortune magazine. And these guys are just up front with their mercenary type pro stuff. And they'll have articles about various mercenaries. These are guys who are now kind of like in these little private corporations, private armies, and all of that type of stuff, like Black Steel and all of that. But they're just mercenaries. It's more corporatized now, but they're still mercenaries. And they are pushing this out as a normal way of conducting oneself, because after all, if you're working for Black Steel or one of these other mercenary groups, and you're defending, quote unquote, America, with the way the empire presents the image about America, then you're all automatically labeled as some kind of freedom type fighter. Now, since Malcolm's time, we've seen that through continuous attacks against the orthodoxy, that it's not as easy for them to present themselves in this light, as more and more people are becoming educated. Unfortunately, it seems to go hand in hand with their ass being on the line, especially in America. America is a population that's so complacent and lackadaisical about other people's lives that until quite often the lives of the wrong type of people in America find their heads on the chopping blocks is before much of the population starts to question. But you can see how in a country that is always labeled people and used various forms of expansion, expansion in its own territory, expansion in the northern hemisphere, and expansion throughout the world, could be so adept at using this type of terminology of extremism, humanitarianism for their imperialist goals. But next, Malcolm further explains the role of the corporate media by the rulers and how his own personal image is manipulated.
So why would such an act in the Congo, which is so clearly criminal, be condoned? It's condoned primarily because it has been glorified by the press and has been made to look beautiful, and therefore the world automatically sanctions it. And this is the role that the press plays. If you study back in history, different wars, always the press, whenever a country that's in power wants to step in unjustly and invade someone else's property, they use the press to make it appear that the area that they're about to invade is filled with savages or filled with people who have gone berserk, or they are raping white women, molesting nuns. They use the same old tactic year in and year out. Now, there was a time when the dark world, people with dark skin, would believe anything that they saw in the papers that originated in Europe. But today, no matter what is put in the paper, they stop and look at it two or three times and try and figure out what is the motive of the writer. And usually they can determine what the motive of the writer is. The powers that be uses the press to give the devil an angelic image and give the image of the devil to the one who's really angelic. They make oppression and exploitation and war actually look like an act of humanitarianism. This is not the kind of extremism that I support or that I go along with. One of the reasons that I think it's necessary for me to clarify my own point personally,
I was in a conversation with a student here on the campus yesterday, and after we were in we had coffee or something, dinner, there were several of us. I have to add that in for those minds of yours that run astray. And she told me that, well, I'm surprised that you're not what I expected. I said, what do you mean? She said, well, I was looking for your wand. And so I told her, I have them, but I keep them hidden. Someone draws them out. As my friend, or that type, it takes certain types to draw them out. This is actually true. Usually, when a person is looked upon as an extremist, anything that person does in your eyesight is extreme. On the other hand, if a person is looked upon as conservative, just about anything they do is conservative. And this comes again through the manipulating of images. What they want you to think that a certain area or a certain person or a certain group is extremist, and what they do, or rather is involved in actions of extremism, the first thing they do is project that person in the image of an extremist. And then anything that he does from then on is extreme. You know, it doesn't make a difference whether it's right or wrong. As far as you're concerned, if the image is wrong, whatever they do is wrong. And this has been done by the Western press and also by the American press, and it has been picked up by the English press and the European press. Whenever any black man in America shows signs of an uncompromising attitude against the injustices that he experiences daily, and shows no tendency whatsoever to compromise with it, then the American press becomes a radical and extreme, somebody who's irresponsible, or as a rebel rouser, or someone who doesn't rationalize in dealing with the problem.
right, so there you heard a couple of aspects of how, you know, this is a continuous thing that we find ourselves in, and how, you know, Malcolm was talking about how the press was using images to justify the particular war that Sam was engaged in against indigenous people throughout the world at the time. So here they are in the Congo, waging a war. Of course, they were in Vietnam, and as Malcolm was saying, the press played its role in that apparatus. Now here we are in 2005, and we see the same thing go on in the role that the press played in helping foment these imperialist war in Iraq. This is also kind of further proof that the Democrats, the liberals, you know, these progressive types, they're ahistorical slash charlatans. When they talk all this rhetoric about we need to take our country back, you know, take the country back from the government, get the Republicans out. This has been a continuous apparatus of the imperial machine. This is not anything new. They always try to present it as something new, as something that just happened. But as Malcolm was pointing out, in the mid-60s, in this debate, that this was a current problem that he was having to have to deal with in December of 1964, and it was a problem that he had witnessed in the past. Now, he also talked about the manipulation of images. So if someone is painted a particular way, conservative or whatever, then that's how they're seen, within a particular light, regardless of what they do. Now, that's kind of interesting because it kind of meshes with the show we did last week, you know, the Pig Talk, where, you know, I played the excerpt of Limbaugh lambasting Daryl Strawberry for being on drugs and calling him a loser and on and on and on and not being responsible and all his diddle heads that were in the audience clapping. Yet at the same time, he's a little crackhead. He's on drugs. But he has the image of being able to speak with authority because he has this quote-unquote conservative label on him. He's just a dupe, a stooge for the ruling elite, regardless of whatever label he has. It's just all a game that these clowns are playing. But here, one of the students at Oxford tries to challenge Malcolm.
Projected rather successfully a quite authentic image of a
class. No, let the gentleman bring out his point. It depends on which angle you look at it, sir. I never try and hide what I am.
I'm referring to your treatment of previous speakers.
You're referring to the my treatment of the previous speakers.
You missed my point. That as long as a white man does it, it's all right. A black man is supposed to have no treatment.
He's an extremist. He's supposed to sit passively and have no feelings, be non-violent, and love his enemy, no matter what kind of attack, be it verbal or otherwise, he's supposed to take it. But if he stands up and in any way tries to defend himself, then he's an extremist.
Speaker who preceded me is getting exactly what he asked for. My reason for believing in extremism, intelligently directed extremism in defense of liberty,
extremism in quest of justice is because I firmly believe in my heart that the day that the black man takes an uncompromising step and realizes that he's within his right, when his own freedom is being jeopardized, to use any means necessary to bring about his freedom or put a halt to that injustice, I don't think he'd be by himself. I live in America where there are only 22 million blacks against probably 150 million whites. One of the reasons that I'm in no way reluctant or hesitant to do whatever is necessary to see that black people do something to protect themselves, I honestly believe that the damage that they do makes whites to have more respect for them, and that there will be more whites on their side than are now on their side with this little wishy-washy love thy heavenly trust that they've been using up to now. And if I'm wrong, then you are racialist.
So, some of the guy's question was somewhat hard to hear, but basically he was questioning Malcolm's tone with the guy that who had spoke preceding him. Who basically was some conservative guy who had, you know, basically painted Malcolm in a particular way. That aspect of the discussion is not on file. Otherwise, I would have played some of that aspect too. But you can hear that Malcolm was responding back to the guy when Malcolm took the podium talking of. In a way, he was saying that, you know, he's not how apartheid is and all of that type of stuff, referring to what the guy had said about him. So the questioner was basically asking Malcolm about his harsh tone, more or less, towards the guy who had been, you know, painting Malcolm in a negative light, which basically proves, as Malcolm said, his point. The guy didn't have, person in the audience didn't have any, concern about, Malcolm being attacked by his debater. But as soon as Malcolm, you know, started firing back, then that's when it became an issue. In the same way that, the state, often, wants to, use the yardstick, and characterize what is acceptable for the people that they're pulverizing, what tactic is and what tactic is not acceptable. So think back to when the war first began and how one ditto head in the military after another, and by de facto, people in the corporate media would come out and complain that the resistant fighters were not fighting properly because they didn't have on uniforms. In other words, they were supposed to line themselves up in the way that Sam and the Samites felt was the responsible way. And if you went outside of those particular bounds, then of course you were being extreme. Now, the fact that Sam was the occupational force there, and any and all people have the right to resist against the occupier, goes outside of the bounds of what the rulers find acceptable, and by de facto, their appendage, the corporate media system. So that type of discussion never comes up. They were just complaining about these guys don't have proper uniform, et cetera, et cetera. Now, while all this type of stuff was going on, they were doing, they had already gotten started in their extreme form of terrorism and torture in Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo, et cetera, et cetera. Meanwhile, they had, done, quote unquote, what they were supposed to as far as painting the masses of people who are resisting against them as the extremist party, as they're occupying. So in the same way that Makram was being challenged on how he should or should not approach someone and deal with someone in his debate, is the same way and mentality that the elite, the orthodoxy, has in how someone should and should not fight them. This is incredible. Here you have an empire talking about someone not wearing a proper uniform, and they're using depleted uranium, a weapon of mass destruction, and they justify their invasion off of lies, which was predicated off of them getting rid of the country's weapons of mass destruction, which they didn't have. The level of hypocrisy and extremism by the state and its machine knows no bounds. But here Makram outlines that regardless of his invisible man beliefs, he's still a black person in America and has to deal with that reality.
I said earlier, in my conclusion, I'm a Muslim. I believe in Allah, I believe in Muhammad, I believe in all of the prophets. I believe in fasting, prayer, charity, and that which is incumbent upon a Muslim to fulfill in order to be a Muslim. In April, I was fortunate to make the Hajj to Mecca and went back again in September to try and carry out my religious function and requirements. But at the same time that I believe in that religion, I have to point out I'm also an American Negro. And I live in a society whose social system is based upon the castration of the black man, whose political system is based on castration of the black man, and whose economy is based upon the castration of the black man. A society which in 1964 has more subtle, deceptive, deceitful methods to make the rest of the world think that it's cleaning up its house, while at the same time, the same things are happening to us in 1964 that happened in 1954, 1924, and in 1984. They came up with what they call a civil rights bill in 1964, supposedly to solve our problem, and after the bill was signed, three civil rights workers were murdered in cold blood. And the FBI head, Hoover, admits that they know who did it. They've known ever since it happened, and they've done nothing about it. Civil rights bill down the drain. No matter how many bills pass, black people in this country, where I'm from, still our lives are not worth 2 cents. And the government has shown its inability, or either its unwillingness, to do whatever is necessary to protect life and property where the black American is concerned. So my contention is that whenever a people come to the conclusion that the government which they have supported proves itself unwilling or proves itself unable to protect our lives and protect our property because we have the wrong color skin, we are not human beings unless we ourselves band together and do whatever, however, whenever is necessary to see that our lives and our property is protected. And I doubt that any person in here would refuse to do the same thing were he in the same position. Or I should say, were he in the same condition.
All right, this points out a number of things. One, that Makram was a secularist. So regardless of his, you know, belief in the invisible kingdom, he didn't try to push it through as part of a political agenda. So, which is why he had the Muslim Mosque incorporated for his, you know, spiritual side and cats who were in, you know, that mold. And then from the political organization, which was separate, he had the Organization of Afro-American Unity, which meant that you didn't have to be in Islam to be a part of if you were politically engaged and want to deal with the issues that the state was imposing in this country and around the world. Then you can join that organization. You can see how things have corroded and lines have blurred in many aspects, not all, where people are using their religion as part of a political instrument and stuff. What's also interesting is how Makram talked about how the various civil rights bills and all of that, and these laws that they have on the book really didn't mean anything in 64. And we can see that they don't now. Because, you know, when you look at the Brown versus Board of Education, the schools are at least as much segregated in a negative way, in a way to intentionally impoverish and disenfranchise and zip code people into a form of tracking system. In other words, if you go to school in at McClyman High School in West Oakland, and so your zip code is 94607, 94608. That zip code for that area means something concerning your grade point average when you try to get into college at other places, because they zip code these areas and stuff. It makes a difference concerning your grade point average compared to someone who comes from a zip code that is considered from a quote unquote a more economically advantaged neighborhood, or if it makes a difference concerning bank loans, the way they redline zip code neighborhoods as far as who they give loans to, qualified quote unquote or not. It makes a difference concerning car insurance, where they push up car insurances in 94607 type neighborhoods, 94608 type neighborhoods, you know. So this is something that's still going on. It's just coded better. But you have a situation where, with all the fair housing, with all the equal opportunity, 50% of black males are unemployed in New York City. Now, black people are about 12 to 13% of the population in America. And about 13% of the drug users in America are black people. So it's about roughly the same population. But 35% of the people arrested for drug possession are black. And 55% of those convicted of drug charges are black. And 74% of those sent to prison are black. So this is how the game is intentionally still played out. They have all these particular laws on the book, but they're laws to be manipulated and targeted at specific portions of the population. So this is how you have a situation where people in Harlem, New York, die at a higher rate in those neighborhoods for various diseases, unrelenting stress, cardiovascular diseases, cancer, untreated medical conditions. They die younger in Harlem than at Bangladesh. And the leading cause of these deaths in these poor neighborhoods, black neighborhoods, is not AIDS. You know, we've gone over how that whole thing's a farce. It's not drugs. It's not homicide. It's the pressure. It's unrelating stress and cardiovascular disease and cancer. These are being under oppressive type of conditions and having various ailments develop and being in the type of areas or have the type of income where you're not getting the proper nutrition. And then on top of that, you're often used as dumping grounds for various corporations putting out various forms of pollutants and stuff. So and this goes hand in hand with, you know, in the last 25 years, one third of public hospitals in the U.S. have closed. And this has happened mainly in inner city and rural areas. So the most economically disenfranchised people are the ones hit the hardest. This is not a coincidence. So once again, all the laws on the books in the world that is basically like the writings on the Constitution. you know, all people are created, you know, But at the same time, an empire raging with all of its hypocrisy and barbarity. But next, Malcolm here states how America is a racist society regardless of what you people here in England are being spoon-fed.
The same thing. I have more respect for a man who lets me know where he stands, even if he's wrong, than the one who comes up like an angel and is nothing but a devil. It will be the system of government that America has consists of committees. There are 16 senatorial committees that govern the country, and 20 congressional committees. 10 of the 16 senatorial committees are in the hands of Southern racialists, senators, who are racialists. 10 of the 20, now this was before the last election, I think it's even more so now. 10 of the 16 committees, senatorial committees, are in the hands of senators who are Southern racialists. 13 of the 20 congressional committees were in the hands of Southern congressmen who are racialists, which means out of the 36 committees that govern the foreign and domestic direction of this government, 23 are in the hands of Southern racialists, men who in no way believe in the equality of man, and men who do anything within their power to say that the black man never gets to the same seat or to the same level that they are on. The reason that these men from that area have this type of power is because America has a seniority system. And these who have that seniority have been there longer than anyone else because the black people in the areas where they live can't vote. And it is only because the black man is deprived of his vote that puts these men in positions of power that give them such influence in the government beyond their actual intellectual or political ability, or even beyond the number of people from the areas that they represent. So we can see in that country that no matter what the federal government professes to be doing, the power of the federal government lies in these committees, and any time a black man or any kind of legislation is proposed to benefit the black man or give the black man his just due, we find that it's locked up in these committees right here. And when they let something through the committee, usually it is so chopped up and fixed up that by the time it becomes law, it's a law that can't be enforced. Well, another example is the Supreme Court desegregation decision that was handed down in 1954. This is a law. And this law, they have not been able to implement this law in New York City, or in Boston, or in Cleveland, or Chicago, or the North City. And my contention is that any time you have a country, supposedly a democracy, supposedly to be the land of the free and the home of the brave, and it can't enforce laws, even in the northernmost cosmopolitan and progressive part of it, that will benefit a black man, if those laws can't be enforced, or this law can't be enforced, how much harder do you think we will get when they pass some civil rights legislation which only involves more laws? If they can't enforce this law, they'll never enforce those laws. So my contention is that we are faced with a racialistic society, a society in which they are deceitful, deceptive, and the only way we can bring about a change is to talk the kind of language, speak the language that they understand. The racialist never understands a peaceful language. The racialist never understands the non-violent language. The racialist, we have defaulted his language to us for 400 years. We have been the victim of his brutality. We are the ones who face his dogs that tear the flesh from our limbs, only because we want to enforce the Supreme Court decision. We are the ones who have our skulls crushed not by the Ku Klux Klan, but by policemen, only because we want to enforce what they call the Supreme Court decision. We are the ones upon whom water hoses are turned with such a cold hammer that it rips the coal from our back, black men, but the coal from the backs of women and children, you've seen it yourself, only because we want to enforce what they call the law. Well, any time you live in a society supposedly and it doesn't enforce its own law because the color of a man's skin happens to be wrong, then I say those people are justified to resort to any means necessary to bring about justice where the government can't give them justice.
So as Malcolm was going over back then, as is still relevant today, the laws are just a way of legitimizing the state and keeping us down while they prop themselves up artificially with labels. There was laws that justified slavery, but the fact of slavery being a human atrocity, well, it's not an atrocity to the extremists within the ruling circles of the world. Now you have a situation where in the U.S. 1% of these American families own 38% of all the wealth in America. 1% owning 38%, and it gets even more ridiculous when you go like the top 10%. You have 34 million people in America who are officially poor, quote-unquote, which is around 25% of all black people in this country and 20% of Latinos. The minimum wage has fallen by about 35% in real terms since its peak in 1968. And the overall American female infant life expectancy is 19th in the world. Male babies in this country is 31st. This is tied with Burundi. And then you take that with the aspect of how race is played, where the average black family has 60% of the income of the average white family. The average African-American family has 18% of the wealth. So 60% of the income of the average white and 18% of the wealth of the average white family. And this shows how the historical legacy of racism grips, where all aspects of the working class are collapsing, and how the crushing poverty and pressure on black people is what it is, and then the stress factors that I mentioned earlier becomes even more apparent. Meanwhile, while all of this madness is going on, what does the rulers try to prop up as a form of normalcy, legitimacy, stability? Their laws. That their laws represent a law and order society, and that no person is above law. Of course, we know this is a charlatan game. The gun laws, the drug laws, the FCC enforced laws against pirate radio and everything else is all a way of ostracizing, demonizing, and pulverizing the particular class of people that the state has its eyes on. They don't respect laws nationally or internationally. This is a group of ruling thugs. In the same way that they hopscotched over international laws and bombarded Iraq. In the same way that Karl Rove ignored the particular laws on the book concerning the little CIA goons and did his little outing and stuff. These are criminals. Their laws don't apply except for those who think that they have some real legitimacy. It's a mind game. But here, Malcolm finishes up as he describes what kind of extremism is he for and what he does not find acceptable. So what extremism is acceptable to him and what is not?
Put in an form of unjustified extremism. But I believe that when a man
is exercising extremism. A human being is exercising extremism in defense of liberty for human beings. It's no vice. And when one is moderate in the pursuit of justice for human beings, I say he's a sinner. And I might add, in my conclusion, in fact, America is one of the best examples when you read its history about extremism. Old Patrick Henry said, liberty or death, that's extreme. I read once passingly about a man named Shakespeare. I only read about him passingly, but I remember one thing he wrote that kind of moved me. He put it in the mouth of Hamlet, I think it was, who said, to be or not to be. He was in doubt about something. Whether it was nobler in the mind of man to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, moderation, or to take up arms against the sea of troubles and by opposing, end them. And I go for that. If you take up arms, you'll end it. But if you sit around and wait for the one who's in power to make up his mind that he should end it, you'll be waiting a long time. And in my opinion, the young generation of white, black, brown, whatever else, they're at a time of extremism, a time of revolution, a time when there's got to be a change. People in power have misused it, and now there has to be a change, and a better world has to be built, and the only way it's going to be built is with extreme methods. And I, for one, will join in with anyone. Don't care what color you are, as long as you want to change this miserable condition that exists on this earth. Thank you.
Now, these are extreme times. Still with us. And the extreme damage that the state is doing, not only on the people of the planet, but on the planet itself, is extreme. In the real sense, 90% of the edible fish population in the ocean collapsed. A dead zone in the Mississippi River. Three holes in the ozone. Populations being targeted for extermination by the extremists of ruling orders in places like the Sudan, being targeted by extremist governments like places in Israel, being under the grips of the imperial boot in places like Iraq. These fools don't know the meaning of harmony with other human beings, the planet, or its resources. They're gougers of it. And yeah, historically and now, extreme measures are going to have to take place to deal with these fools. Hold on a sec.
Thank you.
you know, as we're about to wrap this up, you know, a typical thing happens, but it's kind of played out interesting in certain ways. It deals with 70, 71-year-old baseball manager, Felipe Alou. Felipe Alou is from the Dominican Republic. He's a Latino cat, an Afro-Latino, who played baseball, you know, like 50 years ago, and had to deal with all kinds of madness, you know, in the Jim Crow South, and how baseball dealt with black players and Latinos and the like, et cetera, et cetera. Well, last week, Larry Kruger on KNBR, which is like the flagship station for the San Francisco Giants, where which is the team that Alou coaches, you know, as a manager for. He had been interviewing Alou, and Kruger kind of prides himself as being up on the details of the Giants and so on and so forth, and being critical of various moves and strategies of the manager, or who they're picking, you know, et cetera, et cetera, recruiting, et cetera, et cetera. But he ended up saying this, Larry Kruger ended up saying this about the Caribbean players. Kruger goes, quote, "It's just awful. It really is bad to watch brain-dead Caribbean hitters hacking at slop nightly," unquote. And then he talked about Felipe Alou and said, quote, "You have a manager, Felipe, whose mind has turned to cream of wheat," unquote. And when Kruger said that, Alou, who found out later, because he didn't say it to his face while he was on the air with him, after, you know, Felipe hung up, then he, you know, starts ranting off and stuff like that. So then what basically happened was a situation where when Felipe pressed the issue, and then by de facto the Giants, who have him under contract for not only this year but for the next year, they, you know, more or less sided with him. And then Felipe, it became a national story, and Felipe went out and you know, spoke you know, on like ESPN, and referred to Kruger as basically being a messenger of Satan. So Felipe was pressing the issue. And if you listen to some of the sports shows in the Bay Area, you would have heard overwhelming number of callers say, you know, the guy just made a mistake, meaning Kruger. Why doesn't Felipe let it go? He's being basically extreme. Felipe who refused to accept his apology. So this inflamed many of the callers even more, who saw that Felipe wasn't being forgiven enough. Here's some statement by Gary Radnick. Radnick is also a host on KNBR, and he outlines the dynamic where at first all that happened was Kruger was going to be suspended for like a week, and so he was going to come back after a week and you know, resume his post, and all things were going to be more or less back to normal. Now, you can see why, on a certain level, Felipe wasn't willing to let it go. Because Felipe had dealt with this type of stuff his whole life. And This is what Felipe said, quote, "It made me sad to know that 40, almost 50 years later, we have comments like that, especially in San Francisco. There are more countries represented in San Francisco now than there was when I was a player here, and I never heard anything like that. I heard it in the South and in some other cities, but not here. A man like me and the Latin guys out here, we have to be aware now that racism is not over yet. It's coming back." Unquote. So, basically, you had a dynamic where the Latin dudes were steamed up, because many of them are coming from, you know, some pretty impoverished situations, as his son Moises said about Kruger's comments, and said that they were more or less all too familiar comments being made by people off microphones. And he goes, quote, "In the minor leagues, people think all Dominicans, Mexicans, and Venezuelans are dumb. You think if a guy doesn't speak English, it's because he's stupid. You go to the Dominican and try to have a conversation in Spanish and see how easy it is." Unquote. So, many people were trying to claim that Kruger, you know, just made a slip of the tongue. Why didn't he forget? Now, Kruger has been around for 8 years on the microphone. He knew what he was saying. He was in. He said it with a certain force of racial venom and stuff. Now, what ends up getting flipped around is Felipe, who now is making more money than he ever did when he was a player. He has millions of dollars in his pocket. He's set for life, and he doesn't have all that much longer to live anyway. He just said, "I ain't gonna tolerate this no more. I'm drawing the line just like you guys draw the line." And when Felipe drew the line and refused to accept Kruger's apology, then once again, the same dynamic that what we previously heard Malcolm talking about and us talking about overall as far as extremism and what is not, Felipe is characterized as being the extremist. Now here's Gary Ratness talking about some of the dynamic that was taking place during the first week of Kruger's suspension.
Larry Kruger, which unfortunately, you know, is in a real tough spot, because he's a guy who hasn't been doing this that long, where he's built up goodwill, where people have seen him in situations where he has taken a stand that people may be able to say, "Well, see, I remember when Kruger did this, or Kruger did that, or Kruger's married to a Dominican woman, for Christ," whatever. Larry is out there on an island right now, and I'm going to repeat this till I'm blue in the face. My one defense of Kruger is, I don't think, I'll say it, I don't think Larry at this point in his career is deep enough to do a show where you're dealing in a race. He's dealing in ground ball to third, ground ball to short, let me grab my crotch and spit. Now, I'm not sure Larry's not going to invite me over for dinner after that, but if you listen to Larry's show, there's no personality. Rick is Don Rickles compared to Larry, for criminy's sake. Rick is Don Rickles compared to Larry, but Rick's in the Hall of Fame and gets by with it. Larry's on 7 o'clock at night talking about they should have gone to the bullpen. So what my thing is, again, Larry is not doing a personality-driven show. He's not looking to move to another market. He's not, "Gee, let me out of here in 6 months. I can make $5 more." He wants to stay here. He loves, his problem is, he loves the baseball team. Go ahead.
For sure. This is all the heat. It's because of what he said, or the heat is from the reaction from the fans. Was it what
the heat
said?
Of what he said is coming from the Giants, and particularly Felipe.
Okay, well,
the fans will go on to the next story. The fans don't care. Hell, the media don't care, doesn't even care, but they need something to talk about because the team isn't very good.
Well, I do.
And I don't blame a Lou. If it hits him wrong, it hits him wrong. And nothing you can't quibble with a 71-year-old man who's fought racism all the time. All I'm saying is if he got to know Larry a little bit, he'd find out that that's not where he's coming from.
Okay, Gary, do you think what Larry said was racist or unprofessional?
Stupid.
So that's more like unprofessional.
That's fine, yeah. But I think it was stupid.
Yeah, because there's certain things you probably want to say, or things that are going on in the studio
but your professionalism filters.
No, I pretty much say what I have to say.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But again, I've been doing this longer, you know?
Well, you're a more polished professional than, say, Larry is.
No. I just make more than Larry, that's all. I'll see you.
Okay.
Kevin in Lafayette, you're on KMBR.
Gary.
Yeah, Kevin.
Yeah, hi. Listen, I have to say, I do listen to Larry most nights. I mean, I am a hardcore Giants fan, and I really appreciate what he does. I mean, he's a lot different than a Bruce McGowan or a Kruko, where, you know, he really tells it like it is. And I
Kevin, you imagine, Rick, I got a nice email here. Can you imagine what KMB, if somebody said if Kruger would lose his job, the station would end up with Kruko, Ralph, and Bruce McGowan.
Yeah,
well, and I guess Rick, too.
And Rick, too.
Well, Rick, they tell him he says it. But the point is, you cannot, you know, if you listen as much as I do, believe me on this. This guy is not a racist. If anything, he doesn't have the depth to his program. I'm not talking about real life. What I hear on the radio, he's not interested in talking about is a white guy feud, black guy feud. That's not how he talks. Go ahead.
Yeah, I agree with you. But I'm wondering, though, if Felipe's more upset about the brain dead part, he can't say that, than he is the Caribbean part. And that kind of is something you got to ask yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, Alou's really not doing the job that we expected of him, and maybe it's not all his fault, but I'm kind of thinking he's more upset about that than anything.
All right. You know, Kev, I can't speak for Alou on that. I appreciate your call, though. 808 KMBR, you're listening to the Sports Leader.
It's kind of interesting just letting these guys just. This Babylon and how they just kind of talk themselves. I mean, Radnitz is pretty much, upfront for the most part. But there's an area of denial also with him in confronting these issues of race and stuff. When, look, as I said before, Kruger has been involved in radio professionally, at least at KNBR, for 8 years. He knows what to say and what not to say. He's a seasoned person on this type of stuff. He knows that he can't use words that are deemed by the FCC as vulgar or whatever, however they type them and stuff, because the FCC will come crushing down on their heads. So he doesn't go out of those particular bounds. So when he made the comments about Caribbean players, you know, brain-dead Caribbean hitters hacking at slot nightly. This was not by accident. He was targeting a specific group that he racialized himself and was making a point. Now, this is in the era of you know, kind of like a right-wing demagoguery and, you know, let's throw the PC stuff out the window and just, you know, grind these guys out and all of that type of stuff. So this is what you get from these type of guys. What ended up happening was Kruger was suspended and he was going to come back the following Monday. Now, Felipe refused to accept his apology because, you know, he didn't have to, you know, he's basically sick of it. And but the fans, the corporate media, by and large, the fans had forgiven him right from the beginning. And as you could hear by the way the caller and the callers were trying to phrase things, you know, do you think that the guy was just being stupid or unprofessional? This guy is not a racist. You know, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I'm not trying to say this, you know, Kruger is racist or not or anything like that, but it was obviously a racialist, intentionally explosive comment and stuff. So, what ended up happening was this thing was more or less dying down as the week was coming to an end. And it was announced in the press that Kruger would be suspended, not fired. But then what ended up happening was the morning show that comes on in the morning, Kruger comes on at night, they do a little skit after seeing Kruger, after seeing Alou on TV, they play a part with Alou on the TV, and then they play something from South Park, and, you know, mix in this stuff with Satan, you know, the comment that Alu has said. And so they blow it up, and so the thing blows itself back up again. So now it becomes an issue of these guys thought that, okay, look, our boy's getting off the hook, and before the stuff is even able to die back down, they explode it right back out onto the scene by playing the race card again. Now, when this happened, it became a publicity thing because KNBR has a contract with San Francisco. It's a lucrative contract where they're the San Francisco Giants flagship station. In other words, the games are played or announced on KNBR. So if all of a sudden you have a disgruntled manager and an issue where people are feeling discontent by the managers feeling discontent and pulverized, you have a public relations nightmare for the station. So they ended up firing Larry Kruger, the head station manager, and then the guy who was the like little manager of the morning show. So three people ended up getting the axe and stuff. So this really inflamed many of the listeners. Some saying that that's it, they're through with the Giants, and Alu, you know, the one who pressed this whole thing. In other words, once again, Alu is framed as being the extremist, when all Alu did was push back. And their own hypocrisy and their own arrogance tumbled them in relationship to how the business structure is set up. As we finish this up, Radnix once again talks about, somewhat forthrightly, about how the structure is set up.
Bagnew was fired 16 years as program director. Larry Kruger was fired 8 years as nighttime host. And a young man, Tony Rhine, who is a producer, he's in the morning, all right? The reason they were fired is, number one, well, let me do it chronologically, all right? And I talk to the people in power, whether you want to believe me, whether you want to think I'm a company man, whether you want to think I'm a, you know, I'm a jerk. I mean, you get, but that's what, you know, you're doing a good job when some of them say you're sticking up for Kruger. I got five of them here saying I'm sticking up for Alu by not saying that he wanted these guys fired. No, he wanted somebody else to fire him. He didn't want his own blood on their hands. And Alu doesn't even know who these people are that are fired. But that's another story. Larry Kruger made the Caribbean comment. All right. Alu took it to another level. It had reached a very nervous peak. I spoke with Larry Kruger yesterday, as I have since he was fired. Every day, Larry was thanking me for a few things. We were going to maybe even talk some more about maybe restructuring his delivery, where he didn't take everything as personal. He said Mr. Salvador had told him to start preparing some remarks for his return on Monday night. Okay? This is yesterday. I want to be accurate. I've been saying 2, but probably closer to 1:30. All set up. Kruger would return Monday night. I'd even talked about appearing with him. We're all set. Then late last night, the call comes from Mr. Salvador. And we start to talk. And we discussed this a little bit right before I go on the air. Actually, to be honest with you, the call came from Kruger first in the evening. And then, you know, till I hear from Tony, I'm going to wait and see what's up. Here is the bottom line, whether you want to believe it or not. When Alu did not let the thing roll and stop, it put everything we say from here on out, put everything we say in question, because everyone is listening. Everyone, you know, you're talking billions of dollars in the sale of an entire broadcast group. You're talking millions of dollars here at KNBR. And I'm going to tell you, and I'm not, this is no self-deprecation, and I've said this, you can quote me, for the last 13 years. You build up a following, you work hard. If I'm gone tomorrow, in another week, they'll have somebody else in here. All right? Let alone Larry, who's working 7 to 10 and still learning his craft. You don't make any money from 7 to 10 radio stations. Business always wins. I said this yesterday. We're all expendable. The point, again, is if the first incident was not such a big deal, when the morning show had a little fun playing a Dana Carvey soundbite, which in a sense made fun of Felipe Alou on Wednesday morning. Excuse me, what day is this? This is Wednesday, right? You got three more of these? The soundbite was played yesterday morning. All right? F.P. Santangelo had played for Alou. He's done the voice of Alou. Nobody said a word. But now you can't do those things. And when that thing was played, it became more of just the story of, geez, the audience likes Larry. The station's backing Larry. It became a point for people who own a company. This is, again, my opinion, but I'm telling you that the people who own the company, if they sense that Alou would go crazy again and say, here, these guys haven't learned and taken it to another level, and this publicity machine started, which when it was just starting to die down, and it got out that here they are, the morning show producer, they're making fun of Alou. First it's Kruger last week, now it's the morning show producer. Should Larry have been fired? Hell no. What do you want me to say? Hell no. Should Alou have taken it to that limit? Hell no. He made his point. But he was so volatile, and the Giants, okay, forget that. I'm reading enough Homer stuff here. Do the Giants want someone fired? What purpose does that serve? Larry Kruger would squirm for the rest of the time he spent here at KMBR. The Giants don't have the trade-off.
All right, that's enough. We're running out of time. But what you get out of this is that the firing of Kruger in the end had nothing to do with the fact that these guys are still blatantly playing into an insensitive, racialized game against them. You know, it had nothing to do with that. It had everything to do with that he's part of a machine, the San Francisco Giant corporate machine, that pays big money and works as a big flagship station for KNBR where Kruger is at. You know, they actually broadcast their games. So millions upon millions of dollars are at stake. And if you have people disgruntled within your ranks, and this type of stuff keeps popping up, well, then some heads will have to roll. They were going to let Kruger come back in, but when those guys just went ahead and did something else at the same station, this is why you have the fallout and stuff. In other words, it's all predicated off of image. The corporate machine came down on Kruger, who was already being let off the hook, not because of his statements and stuff, but because of the image that has started to take place when completely different guys, but at the same station, did their little racialized skit. But how is it termed that Felipe didn't let it go? Well, why should he be the one that let it go? He's not the one that's really on the extreme, but those who are in the position of historical privilege will always racialize and see that when those of us of color don't bend over backwards in appeasing them or forgiving them, quote unquote, when they act a fool, that we once again, as Malcolm, as Frederick, as the beat goes on, find ourselves being pictured as extreme. Hold on a sec. That's just going to about wrap it up with Slade tonight as we've run out of time once again. More than a little out of time. But as these fools play their version of an extreme game, filled with racism, extremism, imperialism, extremism, deprivation, extremism, you know, on and on and on, will this do and operate how we know? Because we know that at the end it's time for some real living. Until the next time, Slade.